Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, the seventh state of Australia. My very special guest from one of the other states of Australia is Christopher Field, otherwise kind of known as Topher, like a gopher. I don't know why they call you that, or is it what you call yourself? Welcome to the show anyway.
Well, thank you. It's Topher is actually the second half of Christopher, so it makes as much sense as calling someone Chris. If you're going to shorten someone's name, there's no particular reason to pick the first half over the second. T-O-P-H-E-R.
All right. Okay.
It does kind of make sense in my own little twisted world.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you, but I think we live in a topsy-turvy world, and in order to put it the other way around, you got to do things the opposite way.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that works.
All right. Well, there's a manufactured justification to make ourselves feel better about it anyway. Now, would you be able to explain just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do? And I now know that you've been given a show on American Freedom Radio as well.
Yes, indeed. And, well, for those who haven't sort of come across my show or anything, don't know anything about me, I was born in Australia, lived in Australia all my life, and in Melbourne, actually, for the last 28 years. Frightening myself with how fast time is flying. And so, yes, I'm very much a native of one of the, what I'll say, the original states of Australia before we started adopting our neighbours to the southeast, that being, of course, you over there in New Zealand. And, my first real encounter with the idea that perhaps life and the world wasn't working the way that it should was around about 5-6 years ago. When I began to, we were suffering a very, very severe drought here in the southeast of Australia, and water storages were getting low, and things were actually looking pretty grim for a while there. And I began to look at what our government was doing in response to this drought and in order to try and provide water for all of us. And I began to realize that they were ignoring all of the best options for purely ideological, anti-dam sort of reasons. And they were building a massive desalination plant at huge expense, ridiculous expense, absolutely absurd, and with no justification environmentally, no justification in terms of the water supply itself, no justification economically. If every which way you looked at it, it was worse than some of the other options that they were ignoring. And that kind of was the catalyst for me. And it's funny how we all tend to go through our lives without really questioning much until we see something that we feel like it touches us personally. And that tends to be what wakes people up. Something, you know, the government in some way reaches out and touches you, and all of a sudden you feel a personal stake in what's going on. And it's funny how the water issue did that for me. And what it was realizing that I was, you know, other people, in, you know, kids in my church and young people that I knew on my street and so forth, had never actually had a water fight. As simple and as silly as that sounds, but kids who were born at the very start of the drought that we had here in southeastern Australia had lived their entire life under such strict water restrictions that they were never going to turn a hose on each other. They were never going to fill up water bombs and throw them at each other. They were never going to turn a sprinkler on in the front lawn and run around and jump over it the way that I had done in my own childhood. And such a silly, small little thing, which really, I mean, talk about first world problems. This is not, you know, nobody is dying from a lack of water fights. But that was enough just to begin the process some 5-6 years ago, and things have certainly come a long way in my own mind since then.
I imagine Super Soaker sales weren't terribly high around that point.
yeah, not doing great.
Poor dears.
Terrible.
Yeah. Now, how exactly did you start to get activated as well? What did you start doing? Did you get into film or radio straight away?
Well, that was an interesting one. And it's funny how things in life can work out. A friend of mine knew that I was I had a background in film and television. That's thanks to my dad. My dad was involved in Channel 31, which is a community television station here in Melbourne. Very low budget, very much a case of just giving people access to broadcast. And of course, it was set up before YouTube and these various other options were available. So I grew up doing some editing and some camera work and that sort of thing. And a friend of mine knew that I was looking to get back into that sort of thing. I got out of it once I sort of became an adult. And he heard of an opportunity where a producer here in Australia was starting something at the time called Project Next and was looking for television presenters and news presenters and producers and so forth to staff this show. And as part of the application for a job, you had to put in a video, something that you'd done. So I decided to do a video on the water situation, the thing that was really bugging me at the time, and the fact that we were building a desalination plant when that was definitely not the best of the available options. So I headed out on my own with my own little video camera and made that. Literally, I'd set up the camera, lock it off on the tripod, flip the screen around so I could see it from out in front. I'd walk around in front of the camera and look at myself on that little screen and say my script. And I travelled all over Victoria. I wanted to sort of be on location with each of the things that I was talking about when I talked about dams or water supplies or various other things. And so I then submitted that as my application for a job, essentially, and didn't get the job. Surprise, surprise. What did surprise me was that once I put it up on YouTube, it started to get watched by people. And I began to get phone calls and emails and people agreeing with me and a lot of people saying, oh, finally, someone has got the guts to say what we all know is true, but no one's willing to say. And so that, for me, was sort of the beginning of the process, I guess. I got drawn in after that as more and more people began to say to me, hey, you know, can you cover another subject? Can you talk about this? Can you research that? And that was the beginning of the process that drew me in ultimately to where now I have a YouTube channel with over a dozen sort of videos, mostly dealing with the water issue. That's where I stayed for a number of years. I just continued to deal with the water crisis here in Victoria, and then moving on as I have now into other areas of government and the size of government and broader liberty issues. So I have a YouTube channel, and I have also have, as you mentioned before, a radio station of my own at 9 p.m. on Thursdays Central U.S. time for 2 hours every week.
Mm-hmm. Now, we had Leon Pittard from Fair Dinkum Radio on the show yesterday. Mm. And what he's told me is that Australia is now advancing some kind of really scary sounding draconian free speech censoring kind of legislation. And it's scared the Fosters out of me.
Look, this has been brewing for a while, and you've got to.
Interesting choice of words.
Yes, exactly. You've got to keep in mind with Australia that we are literally at the moment being governed by a former communist who many believe is still a communist, but that she simply changed her stripes in order to be more acceptable. Julia Gillard, don't quote me on the exact details, but I believe she was the editor of the Socialist Forum's weekly or monthly publication for quite some time and was a member for many years of her life. And she dismisses that as almost like a childhood type phase that she went through. But the reality is she was a member for many years, was heavily involved and was responsible for publishing a number of different publications on their behalf. And one of the things that she said while she was the editor there was that it may be necessary for socialists like herself to join other more mainstream political parties and then sway them in their direction, because she felt it would be too difficult under the banner of socialism to achieve what they wanted to achieve. Well, surprise, surprise, she is now, some decade later, the leader of the Labor Party here in Australia, having, in the minds of some people, myself included, I believe that she's simply carrying out the strategy that she put into words all those decades ago. She has now moved into a more mainstream party and is now pulling that mainstream party in the direction of her true ideology, which is genuine socialism, I would say borderline red state communism. She says that she's had a change, that she joined the Labor Party because she grew up and she matured and you know, here she is representing mainstream Australian values. I think the agenda that she's pushing tells us very clearly which one of those two options is true. And it's fairly clear to me that she has not abandoned her true ideology that she held all those years ago. So that's one of the things you need to keep in mind. When we're talking about Australia at the moment, we are led by people who think it would be a wonderful thing to introduce full-on statist communism. Now, they can't come out and publicly say that, but they are pursuing that agenda. So when the do you remember the News of the World hacking scandal over in England a little while ago?
The phone hacking scandal.
Exactly. Now, what that was a subcontractor acting for a subsidiary of an Australian-owned media empire. So think about the links there. A subcontractor acting for a subsidiary did something illegal and immoral. That was the grounds for a sweeping inquiry into the Australian media. Why would you investigate the Australian media when it was a subcontractor of a subsidiary that had done something wrong on the other side of the planet? Well, simply because
maybe if they wanted to use it as an excuse to get rid of journalists and other commentators that were saying things they didn't like.
That's exactly it. They were revealing a pre-existing ideology. They'd wanted to do this for a long time, and finally they felt like they had their chance. Now, that was called the Finkelstein Report, the report that came out of that inquiry, and I dedicated one of my videos to that, and you can find that on a website. If I can just plug my website for a moment, you can find that on a website called forbiddenhistory.com. Forbiddenhistory.com. It's a double D, forbiddenhistory.com. And you'll find there's one out of three videos are up. There's slots for three videos. One of them is there. It's called The Forbidden History of Unpopular People. And it talks all about the fact that ideological advancement over the centuries has often come from people standing alone, speaking their mind, being very unpopular, often persecuted. And in that video, I segue then into the Finkelstein Report and have a look at the recommendations and essentially pull it apart, in my view, of course, because I made the video. So, of course, I think I did a good job. But you're welcome and you're free to have a look at that and decide for yourself. That's had, I think, 60 or 70,000 views now across mostly throughout Australia. And, so that's the first in a trilogy. I'm currently working on the second one. We're getting fairly close to releasing that one. And then the third one will be a fairly quick process. I'm already well into the pre-production of the third one now, but that's another story. So, yes, we are looking at some pretty draconian free speech laws here in Australia. They failed with the Finkelstein report. There was enough of a pushback that they've just dropped that one, and that's persona non grata. Now they don't talk about the Finkelstein report. They've moved on. But they are going to continuously change tactics and continuously look for a way in, so to speak.
What I found is they push the envelope, and if it gets pushed back, they just wait a while, and then they push it again.
They push again, exactly. And so I'm of the view that whenever they push something, we need to start, instead of just stopping them from achieving what they want to achieve, we need to start pushing back and forcing them to lose ground in those areas. And that's what I think is in the process of happening in the US at the moment on gun rights and a few other issues, where the pushback is actually going to outweigh the action on the part of the government. And that's what we need to do over here when it comes to free speech. We need to push back so hard that existing anti-speech legislation, which has gone unquestioned for the last 5 or 10 years, begins to fall apart. And no longer be enforced and begins to be repealed as a result of such a strong pushback because of them trying to take more of our free speech.
And there's an interesting thing we're talking about pushing back. John Key, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, he just had a picture taken and he was holding a T-shirt up in front of him that says, "If this gets 1 million Facebook likes, I will resign as Prime Minister."
You sure that's not a Photoshop job?
I was like.
Dear, if only all politicians would agree to something that simple, eh?
Yeah.
The world would be a better place.
It's just you see quite constantly this Fabian socialist type of mentality. David Icke calls it the totalitarian tiptoe. But what's interesting is that it spreads across both the false right parties and the false left parties. So
absolutely.
In Australia, you've got Gillard enforcing similar draconian policy and things of that nature that we're doing in New Zealand under an alleged right-wing policy by John Key, who said in an open conference that what we're doing is taking a moderate approach and taking small steps in a lot of different sectors, which eventually adds up to a lot. And that's just like, that's Fabian socialism right there. Absolutely. You take little steps and eventually
you get
hammer blow.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we're seeing. And unfortunately, even take, for example, a man that many people hold up as a great example of a conservative prime minister here in Australia, John Howard, was responsible for introducing so-called anti-terror laws that have stripped away a great deal of the natural-born human rights that we have, the presumption of innocence until being proven guilty, the fact that they have to actually lay a charge against you if they're going to detain you and so forth. Now, what we've seen over here is nowhere near as sinister as the NDAA in the US, which has been recently passed by Barack Obama. But nonetheless, it was very, that was a wake up call for me. I used to be in the Australian military, and when I was in the Army Reserves over here, I was actually a supporter of the war in Iraq. And while I was in recruit course itself, the only media we were allowed to see was a half an hour of news every day. And that was at a time when North Korea were doing some of their launching of like test launching of nukes and or potential nuclear missile, you know, carriers and so forth. And there was a real sense that we might be about to go into North Korea. And I'll be honest with you, I was excited by the prospect. I was looking forward to going to war against a tyrant, against this bad, evil country. Now, I still regard North Korea as a tyrant. I still regard them as a bad, evil country. What's changed in my opinion is that I don't regard us or anyone else as the world's police force, that I don't believe that we should be spending our treasure and our blood going into other countries to sort them out, to try and give them democracy from the top down. It doesn't work. Democracy and representative government is something that must be demanded from beneath. It must be the people who stand up and say, no, we want to be represented in our government. If you go into a totalitarian society, replace their totalitarian government with some form of voting system, all they are going to do is vote for a totalitarian government. That's all they know. And unless they have a drive within themselves, a desire for democracy or desire for freedom and representative government, small government themselves, they will fall straight back into the trap that we think we're trying to dig them out of. And we're sacrificing lives and money to put these people on a treadmill that will ultimately not get them what we think it will.
To use a sports analogy, if you want a level playing field, it must come from the grassroots.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it has to. It's like saying, you know, I'm the boss of this house and I have my wife's permission to say so. You know, clearly, if you need your wife's permission, you're not the boss of the house. And it's turning around and asking your government for your freedom is actually, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You're saying that the government has the right to deny it from you in the first place. You know, you're actually putting them above you in the very act of asking them for permission to be free. You're either free or you're not. And going into countries where they don't have that mindset and sacrificing the lives of good men is just, it's counterproductive.
Christopher Field, we'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the semi-operatic Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. And I would also like to remind people that the donate banner to AmericanFreedomRadio.com is now on the homepage, and I would encourage people to support the network. In fact, we had a big meeting last night for how to do a big fundraiser for AFR to get them some new equipment that they need. And me personally, I'm in need of a new computer. This one just can't take the heat. And I mean, literally can't take the heat. It was overheating yesterday. And you know, when computers are overheating, Topher, they just take 10 times as long to do just such a simple thing. And doing the archives and video processing every day, it's just getting too much for this poor machine. And it's going to cost, like, I don't know, $4,000 for another one. And there's no fracking way I can afford that. So hopefully there might be some incredibly generous, lovely person out there who'd be willing to, you know, bail my ass out again. Because let me share something with you, ladies and gentlemen. Not a single one of the things that I am wearing currently on my body, sitting on, or doing my work with, I've bought myself. I'm not kidding. Every camera that I have, every set of lights that I have, every chair that I have, every computer that I have has been given to me by somebody like you. And I just keep working in order to earn more and more equipment so I can just keep working. It's a perpetual cycle, like the Irish, getting drunk, feeling guilty about it, and then getting up in the morning and getting drunk again to deal with it. All right, my very special guest, Topher Field, welcome back.
I'm just trying to compose myself. I'm not sure that that analogy was quite the one you were looking for, but hey, it works. It works. I can relate to your computer overheating problem. I spent years editing my own videos on a fairly old piece of hardware. I put computers together. I buy the parts and put them together myself. And my last build for myself was about 5 years ago. And up until early last year, that was the computer I was still using, trying to edit in HD and all that sort of thing. So I feel your pain, brother, and I trust that that someone gets behind you and gets you what you need. I'm now on a laptop, actually, that's doing the job quite nicely. But no, I feel your pain.
Mm-hmm. And also I wanted to reiterate as well that this is basically this. We're all in the same boat in this movement. Yeah, I mean, if you can show me somebody who actually makes a decent living off of telling the truth without working harder than they should ever have to, point them out to me. Please.
There's a handful. There's only a handful. It's a bit like elite sports. There's a handful of people making you know, quite good money out of what they're doing, and the rest of us are just peddling like mad, trying to keep up with ourselves, really.
Mm-hmm. And even those people who are at the top levels actually earning a decent living, they had to bust their humps hugely in order to get where they are. Like, I remember. I had George Norrie on the show, Topher, and he told me that when he was, I think when Art Bell was kind of getting a bit sick and stuff like that, and he asked George to host in his absence on Coast to Coast, he was doing 4 hours local radio in St. Louis and then traveling across town to the Clear Channel or whatever it is, to then do 4 hours on Coast to Coast, what's right through the night. Good. So doing 8 hours of radio per day.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you. I don't tend to have a lot of guests in my two-hour show, and it usually takes me about 8 hours to prepare 2 hours worth of radio. So I can imagine trying to be on air for 8 hours is a pretty demanding schedule.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even in those positions, you know, you have assistants and things of that nature. But people like you or I mean, we're the one man band. We're like, I don't know, who was that dude in Mary Poppins who literally had like a whole bunch of instruments and stuff like that?
Yeah,
Dick Van Dyke or something.
Yes. Often copied. You see attempts to copy him in amongst buskers from time to time. But you're right. The quintessential one man band.
And. As we were talking about over the break, never underestimate the power of a small, determined minority. And if you think one person can't make a difference, and this happened to you last night, lock yourself in a room with a mosquito and see how that mentality works out for you.
Yeah, and if a mosquito in the room isn't annoying enough, try being sound asleep and having the thing land on the inside of your outer ear canal and see how quickly you manage to jump up and find a light switch to find out what in the world is going on in the room. Kept me awake for around about half an hour before I finally killed that one because it was loud. It had some sort of a cloaking device making it invisible. I could not see no matter how hard I tried. And it had some kind of amplifying device making it impossible to sleep whilst it was in the room. These mosquitoes are getting technologically very advanced. I don't know what gear this thing was carrying, but it was something out of Star Trek. I could not see it no matter how hard I tried. Well, I finally killed it after half an hour, put my head back down on the pillow, and I could hear another one in the room. It had brought a cousin along for the ride, so I ended up just wrapping the pillow around my head so that I couldn't hear it and putting up with the fact that I was going to wake up with mosquito bites. But that is essentially what you and I are to the establishment. Very, very annoying mosquitoes. On the one hand, we should be easily swatted and swept aside, but on the other hand, if there's enough of us, and if we're independent enough, and that's the key, I think, the truth movement as we see it today, it's not a centralized bureaucracy. You can't take one person out. I mean, look at what happened when Andrew Breitbart tragically passed away. If anything, his passing has actually spurred on a lot more people to step up into the void that he left behind. If anything, whilst no one has actually managed to fill his shoes, those were amazing shoes to fill, the sheer number of people who are now stepping up and taking responsibility for speaking out and trying to get the truth out there, I think probably outweighs his individual effort. And that's what we hope to achieve in this movement, is not to create an alternative establishment, but to turn around and say, no, each of us actually has the power and the responsibility to do what we can. It's not about a centralized system. It's not about replacing one status system with another. It's about actually re-empowering the individual to, if I can steal an American term here, to enjoy the pursuit of their own happiness.
Mm. This is why
whichever way they see fit.
This is why I like the mentality and the way American Freedom Radio is done, because it's like a family, and nobody's really even told what to do. You know, they're given advice or anything like that. But you have to be really, really, you have to do something pretty bad in order to get on the wrong side of AFR, I've found. It's just, I've got this aversion to joining groups, to joining teams and things like that that have a top down, you must do this and do it in this way, and that's why I like this network, is because of the freedom that they give me, and essentially I've never even had a curtailing or a criticism of my show from the network in nearly 3 years of being on here, because it's that free.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, I understand the value of corporate structure and so forth, and it's necessary in business and what have you. But when it comes to being a network that prides itself on speaking the truth, really, I have to agree with you. I think these guys have got it right. And, you know, I've listened to a number of other presenters, and I myself don't agree with a number of things that get said. And I'm sure that must be true of the people behind American Freedom Radio itself. But they choose to value freedom above their own particular view of any given subject. And I think that's incredibly valuable and more power to them.
And also, we've been talking, I talked about yesterday on the show about sort of infighting and how it really just plays into the hands of the New World Order, the hook, line, and sinker, doesn't it?
Well, the interesting thing is, it's so easy to allow the small differences to divide rather than the broad brushstroke similarities to unite. There's a film that I'm absolutely in love with. Christian Bale played the lead, called Equilibrium, and it's essentially a post-apocalyptic film. And that I kid you not, is probably the film I've seen more than any other film in my life. There's something about that film, and in particular, something about Christian Bale's performance in that film that I love, and I could watch as many times as there are hours in the day. But there's a particular line in there, and they've got this brainwashing thing going on, and this father figure, who is essentially the head of this totalitarian society, is often up on billboards, and we can hear him speaking and see his face just as people are walking around going about their daily business. And one of the things that he said is that it's an incontrovertible fact that mankind has united with infinitely more purpose in pursuit of war than they ever have in pursuit of peace. And it's interesting. I mean, that's true. As much as that's an awful thing to say, I think historically when you look at it, it tends to be true. And one of the things that we need to do within the truth movement is to change that. We need to actually unite in the pursuit of our own freedom, and the freedom to disagree with each other, than to band together into our own little subgroups and subcultures within the movement in order to pursue our own particular angle on one thing or another.
I do prefer freewheeling collaboration, like, you know, you're independent, you've got your own thing going on, and then we get together and we do something together, and then we both go in our own opposite directions, having endured a positive relationship and actually created something together. That's the mentality that I think is actually going to save this world.
Well, in reality, it comes back to empowering the individual. It's the same as what we were talking about before the break. When you force people into, and the key word here is force, when you force people into corporate type structures and top down hierarchies, you instantly, it has a number of interesting effects. And the analogy that I give whenever, and this is true of a status society, it's true of a company, it's true of any kind of organization that you may wish to look at, the question of individuals taking responsibility for their own individual actions and their own individual lives is a very, very important one. I was talking to a very socialist friend of mine, and he was challenging me and saying, you know, why do you think that the individual can look after themselves better when these bureaucrats have access to more information and better information, and they can make a dispassionate decision from a distance, when, you know, if the individual's making a decision for themselves, everyone's just going to do whatever's best for them? And I said, well, think about it like this. Imagine, and this actually happened to me, this analogy comes from an actual real-world experience. Imagine that you're sitting in the food court of a massive shopping centre, and it was Melbourne Central here in the middle of Melbourne City where I was sitting, and the fire alarm goes off. All of a sudden, you're hearing, whoop, 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 evacuate now. That whole kind of, you know, radio voice that comes over and tells you all to leave the building, and the alarms were going off and so forth. I was sitting there eating or whatever it was that I was eating, and I looked up, and I looked around the room, and you know what I saw? A whole bunch of other people looking back at me. That's all I saw. No one got up out of their chairs and actually left the building. the fire alarm, for all useful purposes, was completely ignored. The only way we were leaving the building was if someone had come running through saying, oh, there's a fire over there, over there, over there. Or maybe if someone in a uniform had physically walked through the area and gone, okay, everyone, sorry, guys, we need you all to leave. Then maybe we would have stood up and started to leave. But the building was so big and the chance of there being a real fire was so remote that we just sat there and went, oh, well, it's not going to affect us. We're not at risk here. It's a massive building. Someone's probably just burnt their toast at a lunchroom somewhere. We could downplay the risks. We could ignore the risks. Now, compare that response, that complete lack of responsibility, as it were. For if you're home alone, just going to bed, you've just turned out the light, put your head down, and the smoke alarm in your kitchen goes off. How quickly do you get out of bed and find out what's going on? How quickly do you get out there and take responsibility? And the simple fact is the reason for the difference in response is because you're the one at risk. No longer is this a massive building with lots of people and I'm sure someone else will take care of it. No, this is your building. This is your life at stake. If this place burns down, you're the one who suffers. And so you respond. And this is the value of individuals. This is the value of empowering individuals. When we say to someone, you are responsible for what happens in your life. You are responsible for providing for your own medical care. You are responsible for providing for your own future. You are responsible for making sure that you get the education that you need in order to continue making career choices along the course of your life. You are responsible for raising the children that you give birth to, and so on and so forth. When we actually turn around and go, no, you the individual, you are individually responsible. Then we start to see people step up. For as long as we move towards this collectivized statist mindset where we're all group responsible, where kind of if everyone's responsible, in the end, no one's responsible. No one cares about the spot fires that start. No one cares about the alarms and the warnings that are being sounded within a collectivist society because that mindset kicks in. Someone else will take care of it. Oh, I'm sure if it was really all that serious, someone would tell me. Until one day something happens, the alarms get ignored and things really do go horribly wrong. And I personally am of the view that we're on the cusp of that right now, that things are in the process economically and socially and in terms of government intervention in our lives are in the process right now of going horribly wrong. And we're ignoring all the alarms. We're just sitting here going, oh, I'm sure someone else will take care of that. Or most people are. You and I aren't. And I would trust that everyone who's listening to us would be on a different page. But society at large is just sitting there thinking that the people sounding the alarm are the kooks, the crazies, the paranoid people, the ones wearing tinfoil hats, all the rest of it, all those sorts of cliched responses that we get when we try and raise the alarm. And essentially, it's because that group mindset has kicked in. It's not my problem. Someone else will take care of it. They're like all of us sitting in that food court in the massive supermarket, hearing the alarm go off and going, yeah, whatever.
Well, a friend of mine once said that if you empower individuals with responsibilities, they become more responsible. If you disempower them by saying those responsibilities are actually somebody else's, they become very irresponsible.
Yeah. It's funny how in society we all know that taxing something is a punishment. We all know that the government from time to time goes, oh, young people are drinking too much alcohol, we're going to raise taxes on alcopops, or people are smoking too much, we're going to raise taxes on cigarettes, because it's going to dissuade people from buying and using those things. And then people like me turn around and go, oh, okay, you do realize that you're taxing and therefore punishing people who work hard. You know, if I choose to spend my day earning a living, you're going to punish me with a tax. And the psychological result is the same.
Right. Topher Field, we'll be right back after the break at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Would encourage people to visit that website and have a look around at all the archives and things of that nature, both for my show and his. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
And no one like me.
Yeah. Welcome back. It's the final segment today of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Topher Field. What was the website again? Was it Forbidden Something?
Well, I've got a few. I need to consolidate them together, but the one that matters the most at the moment is forbiddenhistory.com. That's the one where you'll find my documentary all about free speech here in Australia. If you keep an eye on that, sometime in the next fortnight, I'll be releasing the second in that trilogy, and then within a month or so after that, I'll be releasing the third one in that trilogy, and they deal with taxation and then the size of government, respectively.
Okay, and this is not to be mixed up with For Biden History, which is exposing the background of the current vice president of the United States.
Sure.
Which doesn't exist. I just made it up. But
I couldn't tell. You were so smooth and just it was so believable. I couldn't tell you made that up.
Yeah, I'm a pretty smooth bastard. Now, we're talking over the break about how I preach to the converted. I know I do. I don't deny it. It's because my mentality in this movement isn't actually to wake anybody up. I don't think you can wake anybody up. Nobody forced me to watch 160 freaking documentaries or something like that inside of a 6-month period and radically change my worldview. I don't think you can wake people up. You can say things and ultimately it's their choice. But what I found is once you do wake up, my God. Learning that the entire world is a lie and everything you've been working for your entire life is just BS, that's really depressing. It's really harsh. So my objective is to keep y'all entertained and happy and not depressed, because then you might do what happened to the guy who helped me start Guerrilla Media, which is why the website looks like crap. Go back to sleep and go back to work. I don't want that to happen to you guys.
Work evil, is that the no? That's not the message. Hang on. I'm messing with you. That's where you and I think probably diverge a little bit. And this is interesting for me, because to me, the whole point of this is that it's got to come from individuals, and therefore I'm not in the business of starting massive organizations. This is what we're talking about before the break. I'm not here to start a massive truth movement organization, but I would be thrilled to see other individuals stepping up to the plate as you've done, as I'm in the process of working towards doing. And I think one of the things for me is I look at the way that I got woken up. And as we were talking about when I first came on at the start of this hour, it was feeling that something had touched me, feeling that in some way the government, in as silly as it was, I mean, it was water restrictions and looking at other kids and feeling their loss for not having, you know, run through sprinklers in their front lawns and so forth. I mean, how silly a thing to get woken up over, and yet that for me, that was the beginning. That's what started it. And I guess for me, waking people up isn't about telling them, it's not about telling them that the world is a lie and that everything that they believe is not true. It's about trying to find that one thing where they will have the scales fall off their eyes and go, oh, the government's actually made my life worse in this particular way. A big one at the moment is the bushfires that we've suffered here in Australia. We had a terrible tragedy a few years ago in bushfires. I believe it was 174 people dead in a matter of 2 or 3 days. And the reason why the bushfires were so unbelievably uncontrollable was, one, because the weather was as harsh and severe as it was, and we'd had the drought and so forth. There were some fundamental things that we did not have control over. But two, our Department of Sustainability and Environment, for so-called environmental reasons, had stopped backburning and had allowed the fuel load sitting on the forest floor to exceed the highest classification that they had. They had three classifications for fuel load: low, medium, high. The fuel loads that were on the forest floor or on the floor of the bush when those bushfires came through, I think it was 2009, but don't quote me on that. I haven't looked that up. I wasn't, you know, researching it to prepare to talk about it today. But when those bushfires came through, we had Black Saturday and all those people were killed. The fuel loads on the forest floor were in excess of the highest level of the high rating and had been allowed to accumulate to that point by our own Department of Sustainability and Environment. Now, not only had they not done their job and controlled fuel loads, they also made it illegal for people to collect firewood. You could not, even if you lived there, you couldn't walk out off your own property, you know, half a kilometre into the bush and start dragging massive logs in to chop up firewood. Not allowed to do it. You'll get fined. But that's here's like the real kicker.
That's like freaking medieval. You know, what's next? Prima Nocta?
I'll tell you what's next. There was a gentleman in Kinglake, a town which is quite close to my heart. I'm a motorbike rider, and Kinglake is a rural town up in the hills north of Melbourne. Fantastic bakery up there, and a lot of like-minded people like myself love to get out on the motorbike, and we'll finish, or towards the end of a good day of riding, we'll pull into Kinglake and have, you know, a meat pie at the bakery and just sort of sit and enjoy. And that was one of the hardest hit towns when the bushfires came through. In fact, I was in Kinglake about a half an hour before the bushfires hit. We didn't know the bushfires were coming. and I was on my way home from a motorcycle track day up in a bit further north of there, and we had no idea what was about to happen, and I just rode home as I normally did, and then watched the news that night and found out that the bakery where I'd stopped and had a pie earlier that day was still standing, but the entire town around it had been decimated and a lot of people had lost their lives. Anyway, a gentleman living in King Lake applied to the council to cut down a tree because he felt that that tree was a fire threat to his house. Now, bear in mind, we get told constantly that it's our responsibility to prepare for fire. Every homeowner's responsibility is to make sure that their property is as prepared as it can be. He turned around and said, here is a tree that is on my property that is a fire hazard to my house, and I want to cut it down. Now, firstly, ask yourself the question, why in the world did he have to apply to the council in the first place? It's a tree on his property. That's just madness. Anyway, the council then had the audacity to say, no, you can't cut down a tree on your own property. He said, well, STFU, this is about safety for me and my family. I'm cutting it down. He cut down the tree. They fined him $50,000. That's not a typo. That's not a mistake. 50,000 Australian dollars for cutting down a tree on his own property. Now, where a councillor, a local council, gets the idea that it has that kind of power, I do not know. But here's the kicker. Other people on his street likewise applied to cut down trees and were likewise told that they couldn't. They didn't after what happened to him, the $50,000 fine. When Black Saturday came, you couldn't write a script like this because it would seem too cliched. But when Black Saturday came, one house on that street was left standing. Guess whose it was? It was his. Now, if you wrote a script like that, people would go, oh, no, it wouldn't happen like that. It's too cliche. It's too perfect. No, that's how it happened. One house was left. It was his. The real tragedy, some of his neighbors died in their homes, having not cut down those trees because a councillor told them they couldn't. So I'm pushing that one fairly hard around here at the moment because we just had another raft of bushfires, a few fatalities, nowhere near as bad as last time, but nonetheless, worse than what it could have and should have been had individuals been permitted to actually do what they needed to do to protect themselves and their families.
I reckon those councillors should probably face charges or go down for manslaughter or something.
I wholeheartedly agree, but in order for someone to prosecute that, they would have to expose themselves to the risk of being prosecuted for their own ineptitude, for their own mistakes. The system does not want to prosecute the system.
The fox doesn't want to, criticise other foxes guarding the hen house.
No, exactly, exactly. I mean, that could come back to bite them in a big way. So this is the sort of thing that I get very passionate about because it's a chance for people to stand there and go, hang on, the government did make that worse than it could have been. And maybe for them, that'll be the water crisis, as you know, what the water crisis was for me. Maybe that'll be that one little thing. It's an easy sell. I don't have to try and convince people about New World Order and Agenda 21 or any of the big stuff. Let them discover that stuff for themselves. But I want to get people to that point where in their gut, they accept for the first time in their life that the government actually wasn't acting in their best interests, that the government actually wasn't there for them, but it was there for itself. And that is the beginning of the process. And if I can start that, then fantastic.
Now, you're familiar with the phrase, all roads lead to Rome. And yes. What I've found is it doesn't matter what conspiracy or what form of corruption or what thing happens to you. Like me personally, I was arrested and was going to go to jail for up to 8 years for possession of 13 grams of cannabis.
Wow.
Okay. Like it gets treated as badly as manslaughter. So I got woken up due to the tyranny of the drug war, and then it just kind of spilled over and went into all these other sectors. And so the same can be true of anybody else who wakes up in any other way, I think.
Let me put it to you this way. I have never smoked cannabis. I've not taken any drug that is currently listed as illegal. I barely take Panadol. I've only recently started drinking coffee with caffeine. Like I am as drug free as you could possibly get someone to be. But like these councillors who thought they had the right to tell someone what they could do with a tree on their own property, what gives a government the right to tell you what you can and can't put into your own body? I don't see where that right came from. Now, a lot of people, in order to excuse that right, they talk about harm argument. They talk about, but it's bad. You know, hard drugs are bad. People go to hospital. We have to pay for their medical care. And I sort of say, that's a fantastic argument against socialized medicine. I shouldn't have to pay for other people's stupidity, but nor should the government be stepping in and throwing people in jail for their own stupidity or for their own decisions. I know a lot of people believe that cannabis is actually good and can be used for a whole lot of things. I personally am not on the same page with that, but I am completely on the same page when it comes to your right to choose what you do with your own body and what you do and don't put into it. I do not see how a government thinks it has the authority to tell you what you can and can't put into your own mouth. That is just, and again, if that's what begins the process for someone, fantastic, all the better.
Well, the proviso was, of course, I was selling it. And
yeah. Well, that, and of other course, people, makes you, you know, the scum of
and
the
And other
earth,
people voluntarily came up to me, asked for it, and I provided it for them. Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wasn't forcing it down anybody. I wasn't selling to kids or anything like that. And if you tried to look for the harm that was caused to any of those individuals, it's like, well, hold on a second. Even if there was harm caused by those individuals, they got themselves into it. Ain't my fault. But this mentality that we're talking about here, this, I don't know, it's kind of like grandiose scale mollycoddling. Have you ever seen children who mummy does everything for them and they've gotten to the point where they're like 14 years old and they still can't tie their own shoelaces kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely frightening. There's a reason why we call it the nanny state. It's, you know, it is just the perfect cliche for it.
You know what's unfortunate, Topher, is I reckon we could keep talking about this for quite a while, but we've come to the end of the show.
Yeah, I know. It happens to me every week as well. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
So much to say, so little time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to have you back on about the 27th of February for the United States audience. So that'll be good. We'll go 2 hours, a bit of an expansion on that one. See you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.